We're about to go live, everyone. Are we live? All right. Well, thank you for joining us again today. Just before we begin the actual agenda, I wanted to go over a few items. First of all, I wanted to note that this meeting, this virtual meeting, is being recorded, and the audio portion will be available on the Treasury website shortly after the conclusion of this meeting. In addition, a few technical notes. There is a closed captioning option available. If you look at the little bar of options there, you can see the closed captioning symbol. If you are having any technical issues, please feel free to fill in any comments into the comments section. And then also relatedly for public comments today, please feel free to either submit that in writing to via email, or at the same time, you could also post it to the comments section within Teams as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chair Russell.
Good morning to all. I'd like to make one comment before I ask for approval of the minutes, and that is, looking out on all the technical equipment in front of me, I'm intimidated by them all. The only one that I know how to use competently is the gavel. So, meeting is called to order. Rex, opening remarks.
Sure. Actually, I think it's the minutes.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of last meeting?
Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
Been moved by Treasurer Reed. Is there a second?
Okay.
All those in favor of approval, please signify by saying aye.
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 Approved. Rex?
All right. Well, I am going to keep my comments pretty brief today again, just because we've got a very, very full agenda. And I also wanted to explain that part of the reason why the agenda has been pretty full for the last couple of meetings is because as we're the very first and the second virtual meeting, when we were trying to get comfortable with all this new technology and new setting, we had actively made the choice to keep the agendas a little bit shorter. But at this point, we're trying to catch up a little bit. But I think starting next meeting, we will be back to a little bit of a more normalized pace. So with that, in terms of our agenda today, we are extremely lucky to have our friends and partners from EQT Partners. They're going to walk us through a presentation on how they have successfully integrated ESG into their investment framework. Following on that presentation, we've got two action items for the OIC today. One is a update to the OIC investment beliefs, investment policy IMV 1201. In addition to that, we have the fixed income manager recommendation. And then following on, we will have Ben Mahon provide us his annual review for the alternatives portfolio. And then from there, we'll finish up with a performance review of Q2 asset allocation. And then I will run through a little bit more about the forward calendar again, just to sort of get us back on pace for future meetings. And so with that, I would like to turn it over to our partners at EQT who are – oh, sorry. I made the same mistake again. Thank you, May. So one last thing, the committee updates. There was only one. The Real Estate Committee approved $300 million for Accenturist OR Partners LLC. And so with that, I will stop sharing my screen and ask for our friends at EQT to start sharing their screen.
Great. Good morning or good evening to my colleagues in Europe. My name is Darlene Salmon with the Client Relations team at EQT. I just wanted to thank you for inviting us here today to speak with you about a topic which is a key priority for us across the firm. That's ESG. For those who've spent time with us, you'll know that EQT has consistently promoted not only the importance of sustainable investing, but also making a positive impact in everything we do. This is truly ingrained in our investment ownership and ownership processes. And to give you the full picture today, we thought it'd be helpful for you to hear multiple perspectives. So today, you'll hear from two of our senior investment professionals, Magnus Tornling, a partner with our flagship private equity fund, head of Norway and also global head of our industrial tech sector, and Anna Sundell. She's a managing director with our other flagship, infrastructure, originally from Sweden and head of infrastructure in the UK. And of course, our head of sustainability, Terry S. Lenihag, who's been a driving force behind EQT's own sustainability journey and instrumental in developing the construct which truly defines our ESG practices today. But first, I'd like to introduce Christian Finding. Christian has been with EQT for over 20 years, most recently head of equity, before becoming our CEO and managing partner in January of last year. I'll turn it over to Christian now so he can share his views on this very topical and impactful subject. Thank you.
Thank you, Darlene. Just want to make sure everybody can hear me and see me.
Yes.
Good. Very good. Good morning to everyone. We're really happy to be here today to talk about sustainability and really making an impact. And we have a fairly long presentation. I think you've seen it, but we'll try to be pretty punchy. Feel free to interrupt and ask questions along the way if that's helpful. I want to take a little step back before I go into this slide and say that, you know, EQT is a purpose-driven private equity firm. We've had a purpose since day one when we were founded in 1994. At that point in time, we had a more simple language, so we said, EQT, you know, we want to be more than capital. At that point in time, private equity was basically a capital source. We wanted to do something more than that. We've, of course, developed that over the years, and now our purpose is to future-proof companies and make a positive impact. And through those actions, by making companies better, being the best owner of companies, we ultimately believe that we're going to generate the best returns for our investors, for you guys. And we come back to that, of course, a lot in this presentation. EQT was founded in 1994 by a group coming out of the Wallenberg family holding companies. So we've actually been supported by a family and still are. They still own 20% of EQT that also has sustainability ingrained in how they build businesses. They've been building global businesses like ABB, like Ericsson, and Scania and other companies globally for generations. And their entire empire is actually built on foundations where all the profits go back to charity, actually back to R&D in Sweden. So there's a really positive network that we're a part of and which helped shape us as well. Our culture is also very important to us. Culture is embedded in everything that we do as well, every promotion, every hiring. And that's quite key. So even though we have, I think, 20 offices around the world now, we try to have one, work really hard to have one unified culture and to have that be a part of who we are so that we are a favored partner for all stakeholders that we work with in private equity, which is a lot, of course. We try to be local with locals in every single country that we're investing in. And that's important because then you know, if we're doing a deal in North America or in the U.S., we'll have an American. If we do it in Norway, where I'm from, we'll do it with a Norwegian. If we do it in Spain, we'll do it with the Spanish team. Of course, then bringing also EQT's global knowledge to bear. So on top of being local, we also invest thematically. We find themes that we invest behind and go into certain sectors. And those themes are typically or are always actually based on long-term secular trends, which are global and which we believe will continue for the long term. And when they continue for the long term, normally they will also be good for the world. So we try to connect what's good for the world with our thematic investment strategy and then really drive transformation in the companies behind that. We drive these transformations with a set of EQT advisors, as we call them, which are CEOs and chairmen of and chairpersons of companies from around the world in different sectors, and they help our companies, again, to develop. They help us choose the companies, give us good advice when we're going in. They give us good advice when we're exiting. But most importantly, they're really good at helping companies develop. And at the end of the day, a lot of value creation is happening in private equity. And when I say private equity, I mean the broader private market space, including infrastructure, of course, where we invested, on transforming these assets and these companies to be something better and more valuable over time. We manage about 40 billion euros, so what is $45 billion plus, meaning we're top seven in the world or something like that. We believe we're going to be top five in the world in all of our strategies over time. We already are in infrastructure. We believe that our long-term approach, which has delivered quite strong performance, over 20% net since 1994 in the private equity fund, and we're in high teens also for the infrastructure funds, which have been investing since 2008. We're now raising fund number five in that strategy. We also know that it's not enough just to really build in this philosophy. We need to take it to the next level all the time and continuously improve. Therese will talk about that, how we now integrate actual sustainability actions into all of our value creation plans, into everything we do. Private equity, also hear from Magnus and Anna about that. And we do this because we think it's the right thing for the world, but it's also the right thing, and I'll say it again, we really do believe that this type of strategy where you truly embed sustainability into everything you do ultimately will lead to better returns. And again, the example that I typically give is if you have two companies that are exactly the same and one company can become more sustainable or is more sustainable than the other, which one over time will attract the best people? Which one will have the best relationships with regulators? Which one will have the best relationships with other stakeholders in society? Well, it's going to be the company that's more sustainable. And that means that company is also going to generate a better financial return. So we really think this is these two things are truly come together. And that's also why we're not going to start an impact fund at EQT, because we want to make sure that we have an impact, again, in everything that we do. So I'm really happy that you're also on this path, and that we have a great partnership with you. And I think I'll probably wind my introduction there down. I'll be back towards the end. And again, feel free to ask questions, jump in. And we look forward to a good discussion. Therese, the floor is yours.
Mr. Sinning, it's John Russell.
Yeah.
May I ask you to expand a bit on the role of your EQT advisors?
Mm-hmm. Yes. When we were founded, we had a number of leading executives around EQT that were going to help us govern our companies in a good way. And we've developed that to a global network together with the Wallenbergs, but also our own. And, as an example, we have when we're doing a healthcare investment, for example, we own a company called Certara, which is a really cool company in the U.S. that we're hoping to take public soon. The chairperson of Certara is Sherry McCoy. She used to be one of the top executives at Johnson & Johnson and a number of other exciting roles in the healthcare and pharma space. So we populate a board together with her on competence that's needed to develop Certara. And we needed digital and software competence. We needed a global network in healthcare, et cetera. So we picked three or four persons from our network or outside the network if we don't have the specialist to work on the board together with us, together with one or two people from EQT. So we keep it really small. And then that team really works as a coach and as a resource for management, again, so that we can take the right decisions and we can take quick decisions to develop the companies further. We also use them when we're meeting management teams for the first time. So, we never become true specialists in the industry, but if we bring some executives along with us who are specialists, we automatically have a dialogue with the counterparty about their business, which is much more intelligent and at a higher level, and not so financially oriented, which is the easy trap to fall into in our world.
Thank you.
Great. Shall I jump in then, Chris? Thank you for that introduction. And can everyone hear me as well?
Yes.
Excellent.
Well, I would like also to reiterate how honored we are to have been invited to speak on this topic of sustainability, or actually, as we prefer to call it, future-proofing. Because I don't know about the people on the line today, but my observation following now more than 15 years in the investment industry is that sustainability and impact actually have a tendency to create quite strong feelings, and the conversation quickly runs the risk of becoming personal or political. I would be lying if I didn't say, and you heard that from Darlene, that I'm very passionate about the topic, but I am, and we all are, as you heard also from Chris, passionate and obsessed by facts. Obsessed by ensuring that we as investors and owners, as business leaders and board members, have the high quality, relevant and objective information that we need at our fingertips to be able to make these enlightened, wise decisions that will future-proof the EQT portfolio companies and as such, the returns of the EQT funds, EQT and also society. And it's actually my conviction that sustainability or ESG, environmental, social and governance information, has the potential to do to finance what X-ray did to medicine. But I will also do a bit like Chris, start by taking a step back. And why are we as an industry, as a firm here? If we go back 26 years to EQT's inception, or a decade ago when we launched the first version of EQT's responsible investment policy, the answer was to support the development of portfolio companies to build long-term value and generate superior returns for investors. That is still true, but it's not enough. Today's society, our stakeholders, demand more. Take pension funds such as yourself. You're looking for top decile, top quartile returns, but you're also looking for a world in which Oregonians not only can afford to retire, but also want to retire in. Or university endowments, they're not only looking for returns to fund the next scientific discovery, but for a world in which students thrive as they enter the workforce. And speaking of workforce, EQT is a people's business. Without talent, EQT is nothing. And talent today is looking for purpose, especially younger generations. We all want to feel that we're part of something bigger, that we are investing in and building the future we want. And that is also why we at EQT demand more of ourselves. Today, as you heard from Christian, EQT's purpose is to future-proof companies and make a positive impact with everything we do. We do not have a separate impact fund because it is our belief that aiming for positive impact in everything we do is how we secure attractive risk-adjusted returns for our clients, the investors in EQT funds. Sustainability and strong returns are not mutually exclusive. They are mutually reinforcing. But who are those next generation successful companies that will combine profit, purpose, and positive impact? We actually believe that the answer lies in embracing the sustainability agenda and use it as a tool for value creation. From deal sourcing, during due diligence and ownership, through to exit. Embracing the sustainability agenda presents us with great opportunities. It will help us attract and retain the best talent through purpose and high engagement. This goes for EQT, our portfolio companies, and also our advisors, as just discussed. It will help us attract funding by being a solutions provider and safe pair of hands. This goes not only for the fund investors, but increasingly also so for the debt providers we've seen. Identify the most attractive deal flow and be the preferred buyer as management teams are looking for partners on this sustainability journey. And ultimately, create top decile returns through positive impact, securing an everlasting virtuous circle. So why are we seeing this increased interest in making a positive impact in the public and private markets? The graphs on this page illustrate the new world we live in. The dotted lines mark the year 1950 and collectively go under the name the Great Acceleration, based on the International Geosphere Biosphere Program's research. While there have been great breakthroughs for humankind and tremendous developments since the 1950s, with population growing from 2.5 to 7.8 billion, world GDP rising from 5.3 trillion to more than 80 trillion US dollars, and vast technology development, to only mention a few, this has come at a cost. We used to be a small world on a big planet, but are now a big world on a small planet. The right-hand graphs show how socioeconomic developments are putting an enormous strain on our planet. Atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are at record highs, the Arctic is melting, and the oceans are dying. Every system, every organization that ignores feedback dies. This is feedback from our greatest system. We're not witnessing cyclical trends. We are seeing secular, exponential Earth system trends that must be rapidly broken and reversed. Corporate leaders see this. Investors and banks see this. Policymakers and regulators see this. New generations see this. All being critical stakeholder group that we as investors and owners and the portfolio companies must respond to remain relevant and successful. While the world is facing major environmental and social challenges, as investors, we know that where there is risk, there is also opportunity. With over 45 billion US dollars in assets under management entrusted to us by a blue chip investor base with high expectations, top talent, a global network of experienced and engaged advisors, and a business model that really allows us to effect real change, Ekini is extremely well positioned to capture these opportunities. Thanks to the creative design, actually by a Swedish company, people around the globe today recognize these 17 sustainable development goals. These were adopted by all United Nations member states in 2015 and provide an opportunity blueprint to address the major environmental and social challenges society faces, now and into the future. Using EQT's vocabulary, the SDGs are the world's full potential plan. And as any full potential plan, we know that it will require investments and resources to achieve it. Meaning we need to align investment and ownership goals, business goals, with the global goals. These goals have not only caught countries' attention. Again, corporate leaders, investors, banks, policymakers, regulators, and next generations have also taken this agenda to heart. One goal stands out, climate action. Climate change, or the climate crisis as it is increasingly being referred to, is a top concern. To give a local example, also illustrating the power of the people, when the US announced its withdrawal from the Paris Agreement at federal level, the governors of California, Washington, and New York joined forces on state level to support the international agreement. Since then, the U.S. Climate Alliance has grown to a bipartisan coalition of 25 governors, including Oregon's. Currently, the U.S. Climate Alliance represents 55% of the U.S. population, 40% of the U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, and an $11 trillion U.S. dollar economy, an economy larger than all countries but the U.S. and China. So what has EQT done in practice then to embrace the sustainability agenda? What have we done to promote sustainability as a tool for value creation with our portfolio companies and also to lead by example? As Darlene alluded to, it has been a journey which we continue to travel. The formal 21st century sustainability journey, as I like to call it, started with an ambition to enhance transparency, to build trust with external stakeholders and safeguard our license to operate. Our industry hasn't necessarily been famous for transparency, quite the opposite. It has been known to be protective of the private and private equity. One milestone was therefore reached already in 2009, when we published our first annual review. Yet two more milestones were reached in 2010, when we, as pioneers in the industry actually, publicly published and committed to the first version of our responsible investment policy, as well as became the first Nordic private equity signatory to the PRI. PRI, for those of you who are not familiar with it, is the world's largest international network of investors incorporating sustainability into their investment decision-making and ownership practices, representing around $100 trillion of assets under management. In 2014, we took things to the next level by introducing the EQT Sustainability Blueprint. The blueprint is a guidance document designed for portfolio companies to stimulate a holistic, innovative, and strategic perspective on sustainability. And I will come back to the blueprint, and we will also come back to what the future journey holds, but we'll now dive deeper into the EQT investment process. As we all know, the practical art of investing starts with sourcing and analysis. It is about finding and buying the right company in the right industry with the right people. In terms of finding the right industry and company, at EQT, a key tenet of ours across the platform has been to invest with the trends. And in fact, there is no bigger, more important trend than to invest in the future we want. A mindset that is underpinning EQT's thematic investment approach and formalized in our responsible investment and ownership policy. Today, as the EQT teams investigate in which niches to play and what companies to buy, we ask ourselves some simple but very telling questions from a societal impact perspective. How well did this industry's trends align with the SDGs? How does this company contribute to or impact society? Does its product or service work well in a world of 8 going on 10 billion people, providing affordable access to products or services while respecting planetary boundaries? And how is EQT going to strengthen or mitigate these impacts? The answers to these questions will be addressed in sourcing, during due diligence, and presented to the investment committee as the deal moves through the investment recommendation stages, critical to the investment decision and the value creation plans put in place. While our approach to sustainability due diligence today does not stipulate a long checklist or by default require an isolated separate work stream, in fact, we are much in favor of an integrated approach also here, where relevant ESG topics are addressed by the most suitable advisor, there are some clear expectations and guidance for the investment advisory teams. One, they must assess what the potential material ESG issues are for the company and its value chain. Here, the teams have access to the EQT Sustainability Network, both EQT's dedicated sustainability resources and the ambassadors, the EQT sector teams, the EQT network of advisors, and the EQT Sustainability Toolbox, with industry guides and research, among other things. Two, they must assess what the company's performance on these material ESG aspects are, past, current, and future outlook. Here, relative peer benchmarking plays an important role in identifying strengths and potentials. It is also important to consider what the future stakeholder expectations are on the company's absolute performance. Again, the SDGs serve as a very good North Star here. And three, understand the current organizational governance setup and resources. These steps will typically provide good insights on how attractive the investment is, what should be considered from a valuation and SPA negotiation point of view, as well as lay a good foundation for concrete actions post-acquisition should we win the deal. And that brings us to the ownership phase and back to the sustainability blueprint. As I mentioned earlier, the blueprint is a guidance document to stimulate holistic, innovative, and strategic perspective on sustainability. As portfolio companies become members of the EQT family, they get introduced to EQT's sustainability philosophy and expectations through the blueprint. True to EQT's and our founder's motto, everything can always be improved, this document is a living document. We constantly challenge and upgrade our ways of working. So as you can see, we're now on version 3.0, following market developments and valuable input from stakeholders. What the second and third versions have, which the first one didn't, is the EQT Sustainability Performance or Societal Impact Framework. The framework is a tool to visualize how EQT can accelerate action, ensure positive impact, and create value from sustainability, both as we evaluate what to invest in and how we drive value during our ownership. The solutions axis assesses what the company does, what products and services it delivers, and how these products and services contribute to solving environmental and social challenges using the lens of the SDGs. The other dimension relates to how the company does it, how sustainable its business practices are, based on EQT's ownership expectations expressed in the blueprint. This is a flexible framework with several attractive value creation pots. The EQT funds can support the transformation of a portfolio company with a negative societal impact profile to a positive one through the strategic actions identified as part of the investment thesis and full potential plans. Or invest in companies with already strong positive profiles and help them scale and develop as organizations. If I zoom in on the practices axis, these are the EQT sustainability ownership expectations, which we have actually been following up the EQT funds portfolio companies on since 2015 to understand where they are on their journey. The expectations of portfolio companies fall into three categories. We have A, the EQT absolutes, which are four actions to build a sound sustainability foundation. We have B, the EQT core KPIs, which are six core KPIs to inspire and foster sustainable value-creating behavior of a systemic nature and need. We call this beta engagement. Or C, portfolio company-specific KPIs, which is three minimum KPIs designed to capture and manage sector, market, and company-specific opportunities and risks, so-called alpha engagement. All these expectations are followed up on during the first few months each year through a structured process in EQT's portfolio company data collection tool, the same one we use for financial portfolio company data, with key elements also being channeled to LPs through the fund reporting. So now to make these questions and frameworks and systems come alive, also emphasizing the importance, what is unique of each company, what is this alpha in each of the companies. I'm very happy to let Anna and Magnus present some concrete examples from the portfolio, starting off with Anna and Hector Rail, a company which has just been successfully exited.
Can you understand a question, please?
Absolutely.
John Russell, a couple of questions. I'm not familiar with the acronym KPI.
So that stands for a key performance indicator.
Okay. And way back on page 14 and 15, you said what the dotted line time frame represented, but I missed that.
So literally, the dotted timeline is the year 1950. So as you can see from this human impact box, it's literally the period after the Second World War II, which a number of scientists are calling the Great Acceleration.
Thank you.
And this is Monica Enand. I had a question as well. How long have you been tracking those KPIs, and have you done any correlation in the portfolio over time and found that one or the other of them more highly correlates to long-term performance?
So the way that we have followed up initially on the KPIs, as I mentioned, we've done this since 2015. To begin with, we used it very much as a management tool where we actually scored companies in each of these different buckets. So we could also track the portfolio and how they were maturing in terms of their own governance processes and mindset. And I think it's actually only now that we're starting to see proper quality data coming through so that you can also start looking at the correlations. But I think it's fair to say that it's been a very interesting exercise to also see what the relationship is between highly thematic investments and those that may be more struggling against the trend and the resilience of those investments.
Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Anna Sundel here, Managing Director in the Infrastructure Fund. We could, yes, Therese, if you could, yes, move. Thank you very much. Can you hear me well? So as a background, EQT has invested in the rail freight market through our investment into the Hector Rail Group, which provides traction services, so locos and drivers in Scandinavia, German, UK, to industrial companies in construction, energy, and timber sectors. We identified very early on strong macro drivers and trends in this sector, including the increasing environmental focus, containerized trade, modal shift, and a strong political support underpinning the growth and focus of the sector. And comparing to road, rail has a clear cost and environmental benefit. As an example, an average freight train moves 50 to 60 truckloads equivalents, reducing congestions and also emissions. In Scandinavia, where the main tracks are electrical, the emissions are closing into zero when using the electrical locos. So contributing to growth and modernizing and future-proofing companies, we're also contributing to the sustainable development. And that has been part of our thematic angle into this investment. With Hector Rail, which we invested in 2015, I worked closely with Therese and the team, and Hector Rail was one of the first pilots back in 2016. And we have identified the key KPIs, materiality assessments, impact, all which are now part of the requirements of all of our portfolio companies. But really to focus on two areas, safety and investments, in how we are future-proofing our companies. And starting with safety, we have had a strong focus on safety, and this is clearly a must for customers, regulators, employees. And a focused safety work has clear revenue and cost benefits and also on stakeholder relationships. Through our ownership period, we have done continuous improvement into this area, lifting it up to the very first topic in boards and troikas and aiming at a zero risk event and accident, and also enforcing a strong safety culture in the company. And just to give a concrete example, we introduced mobile apps for instant reporting, follow-ups, and also to get policy documents out to drivers and ensuring quick and communication and safety messages. In 2019, we established a safety index to track the development. So when we exited Hector Rail earlier this year, we could demonstrate a positive trend on the safety work that we had done in the organization. The second part of future-proofing has been the investment into the company in locos and in IT systems, both improving on the environmental side, but also on the utilization of assets. And a couple of points there. We have invested in more than 90 locomotives to streamline the fleet, to have a newer and more modern local fleet, improving the operational reliability as well as meeting customer demand. And over these years, we have delivered more than 70% growth in revenues, enabling customers to actually choose rail versus road. 20 of these locos were Siemens Vectron locos, enabling longer trains and more efficient use of the assets, and reducing energy with more than 20% in the operations. Another part has been investments into IT systems and tools for planning. And investing into digitalization has allowed us to operate remotely now during COVID. So we have been able to continue running on almost 100% of our services, taking train and services from the northern part of Sweden down in Europe. Another part has been investing into application for driver apps for eco driving, including training and benchmarking system, ranking drivers on energy efficiencies on comparable distances. And just to conclude here, we just recently sold Hector Rail a few weeks ago, and we made 1.9 times and 19% IRRs on this transaction. This is great results, and it's about our investment targets and also the underwritten case. I think this is a great example on how we can both do a good investment and also have a positive impact, future-proofing a company in a very conservative industry and also supporting the SDGs.
It's John Russell, if I may. You should take comfort in the fact that many of us in the U.S. are jealous of the European and Asian rail networks.
Yeah, thank you. No, I think there are a lot still to be done also in Europe when it comes to this industry and how it is conservative, but I think that the investment into mainly the digital tools has done a huge great for this investment. And also for how the company can continue developing going forward.
Great, thank you, Anna. Shall we turn it over to Magnus and we cover Nordic?
Super, thanks Teresa and thanks Anna. So as a quick background, Recover Nordic is the leading damage control and environmental services player in the Nordics and was acquired by EQT8 in March 2020. Recover Nordic seeks to contribute to a cleaner climate through property remediation and service innovation and is considered an ESG leader in the industry. One of the things that attracted us to Recover Nordic was the company's strong ESG profile and value creation potential through sustainability. Recover Nordic's most important customers are insurance companies who are increasingly, especially in the Nordics, measuring the sustainability profile of their service providers and use this data to rank Recover Nordic and its peers. Hence, in the damage control industry, it is of huge importance to be best in class on sustainability to win business and also increase share of wallet with customers, and the company can achieve a higher price for its services through its ESG focus. So it's not just only a hygiene factor, it translates into greater profit. A recent example of a successful sustainability initiative in Recover Nordic is the company's waste-to-cash project. Last year, Recover Nordic launched a project in Norway where the company set the target to sort 75% of all waste from projects on site. And waste sorting does not only promote a circular economy, but also creates value for Recover Nordic as the time spent on sorting the waste can actually be invoiced to customers and thus increase revenue per project. At the time of the project launch, 33% of all the waste in Norway was sorted on-site. Today, the company has reached its targets with a 75% sorting rate, and we see a pickup in margins. Another example of how Recover Nordic is contributing to a cleaner climate through service innovation is Recover Nordic's Digibox. And Recover Nordic has, over the past few years, developed a proprietary sensor and remote monitoring kit called the Digibox, which is compatible with the company's dehumidification machines. So the Digibox allows the company's employees to remotely track the drying processes following water damages and then prevents employees from wasting time and cost of driving to customer sites to check how far the drying process has come. And the Digibox has been tested now in all Nordic countries over the last few months. And preliminary estimates show that the CO2 footprint relating to transport is reduced with some 15% using the Digibox, but it also has a very large cost-saving potential. But the first estimate shows that the use of the Digibox can reduce a cost by a project with up to 30%. It's still early day in EQT's ownership period. We have a strong confidence in Recover Nordic's value creation potential plan driven by sustainability. So this was just a few examples of what the company has achieved so far, but there are several other projects ongoing, both to reduce the CEO footprint and other initiatives, which will be very important for the company's full potential plan. And as Chris conveyed very well in the start, and Teresa as well, sustainability is ingrained in everything we do. So the sustainability angle has an own slide in the first new deal committee material. It's included in every performance review we have on a company. And this is why it's so important that I think Therese made very good comment on, that the sustainability targets that we set are measurable. Because what measured, what you can measure actually will get done. So that was a short update on Recover Nordic. Any questions before I hand over to Chris and Teresa?
Excellent. Then we'll move on, and I'm sure there will be more questions at the end. But I can only reiterate, thank you, Magnus, and thank you, Anna, for making all our frameworks and different guidelines and tools come alive. It's really critical. One cannot work without the other, and it is this alpha and beta engagement that really makes a difference. And as Magnus said, I think these case studies are great examples, not only of how integral sustainability or future-proofing is to the EQT investment process and organization, but they were also both fantastic examples of the potential that EQT has to accelerate action and make a positive impact at scale. With that said, as we enter an era of purpose-driven thematic investing, genuine and authentic leadership has never been more important. And EQT as an organization must continue to act as a role model, to lead by example. Earlier this year, following extensive analysis and dialogue with stakeholders, EQT therefore yet again decided to take things to the next level by articulating our elevated societal ambitions, all firmly aligned with the 17 SDGs. We have identified four dimensions of particular importance to drive performance, value, and positive contribution. These dimensions and ambitions are transparency and accountability, where we want to continue to champion transparency to build trust, and both of these are really prerequisites for business success. Diversity and upskilling, where we want to attract and nurture a diverse, world-class EQT team and network. Clean and conscious, where we recognize that we need to transform our ways of operating in line with the science. And finally, innovation and partnerships are critical enablers to move at the pace and with the scale that we want and need. These ambitions, we have publicly communicated with commitment from the top, and I am very happy to hand back to Chris to personally embody this commitment.
Thanks, Therese. This one is kind of interesting. We talk about the fact that we've been purpose-driven since day one. And we believe actually purpose-driven companies that clearly know what they're here to do on Earth, and thus through their operations and their strategy and their people create value for all stakeholders. We decided to actually set our statement of purpose as a core pillar of our governance, and actually all of us in the board, including myself as CEO, signed this formal statement of purpose, which kind of talks about what we've been talking about here. And we also actually went and modified our articles of association to include our purpose in the articles of association. And formally that doesn't necessarily matter so much, but it's an important symbolic move that we actually are really in our governance and in our statutes are actually building in purpose. And we're one of the first companies in Sweden, if not the first company in Sweden, to do it. We're one of the first companies in the world to do this, and we're definitely one of the first, if not the first, private equity firm that's doing it. So that was interesting. We even had to have discussions with the with the regulators in Sweden, because they haven't been part of that kind of discussion before. And that was also really interesting. They took it very well, and we gave us some feedback, and now it's part of our part of our formalized system. And again, all these things together come to make this positive impact. And that's I think been very well received by the stakeholders who engage with us on it. Now we can go to the next page, which is what is it that we've actually done more concretely at the EQT level to make bigger changes in what we're doing. And this year we've been particularly focused on two areas that Therese already covered. One is diversity. We're fairly diverse at EQT in terms of nationality. I think we have 42 or 44 nationalities at EQT and lots of different backgrounds, but we are underrepresented in particular in gender, but also in race. This year we're focusing on gender. So we set some very concrete targets that we would hire at least 65% investment professionals to be female this year. And we also did the same for our boards, but at a slightly different level. We said at least 25% of our board should be represented by the underrepresented gender. And then we connected, actually, some of our bonus incentives, et cetera, to setting those goals just to create some extra momentum internally. And that's been really driving a lot of positive movement and acceleration to create more diversity at EQT. And we believe diversity actually will also lead to better returns at the end of the day, better performance, which I think is now proven in many different studies. And then the second thing we did was on clean and conscious, we have set all of our portfolio companies on a path towards renewable energy. And of course, it's very different between a software company that's already using a lot of renewable energy for their data centers to companies that have more of a physical infrastructure. But all of them are supposed to move in the right direction and take concrete actions based on their value creation plans. We believe by doing these kinds of things that we'll drive better performance, we'll create better companies, and ultimately, again, better returns. So I think, the other ones I think Therese has covered quite well. So then I think we can go to the final page, I believe it is. This one we covered already, and Magnus took that one. We end up on this page, which we really believe, which is to future-proof companies and make a positive impact. And we believe, in particular, active owners, in the private market space, but also those that are in the public space can actually, bring this investment philosophy to bear, improving the planet through the actions that business can take, and at the same time creating good financial returns, which is also important for all of our clients and all of their dependents, of course. So with those words, thanks to the team. We're all going to stay on for Q&A. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's John Russell. Any questions from council members? Treasurer Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tobias Reed here. I'm particularly appreciative of the way you set all of this up as a driver for increased success and profitability in the conventional measures, admitting that those are imperfect and incomplete measures. That puts us on really solid ground. So two things that occur to me is sort of philosophical questions. One, recognizing that there are obviously circumstances that will be particular to whatever company. I wonder if you have a thought about whether it's better to invest in a hypothetical company that is a low performer on ESG metrics with the idea that you can help them improve, or high performer in order to continue that and take advantage of that difference.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. We debate that a lot. I'll start and see if any colleagues want to add to it. Given that private equity, we're on the one hand we're long-term owners. On the other hand, we typically own companies for 4 or 5 years or so. So it's not an endless time frame. We will, at EQT at least, we will tend towards those companies that are already reasonably good and in a reasonably healthy industry where we can help accelerate change and kind of from there to companies that are already very sustainable that we can really accelerate and globalize or whatever it might be. There is a very important role to play also for those, if you take the carbon space, the whole oil and gas sector, to drive the transition from carbon to renewables is also an important role. That takes a lot of time and may not be suited always to our kind of private equity. But we are actually now about to start building a long-term investment strategy, which will invest for 15 years plus, and to find companies that can help to drive that kind of change that you're talking about. So there, I think we'll be able to have more impact and maybe think a little bit differently. But our philosophy will more of the time be towards those industries and those sectors which really have a very long-term future. See if there's anything to add.
Yeah, I can add a bit on and relating back to some of maybe the more theoretical frameworks that I explained. This is why it's so important to both have the relative benchmarking and the absolute benchmarking to understand whether this industry is actually going to be a future-proofed industry and be able to live up to those societal expectations and needs, or whether they over time will become a stranded asset. And of course, here we need to then have belief in the innovative powers of that company, because very often it will require then technology advances.
One more question, Mr. Chair.
Question from Treasurer Reid.
Thank you. One other one. Thinking about the way you described the ambition, actually, as it's articulated on the slide, future-proof companies is very appealing too. So we've talked about here sort of one measure of success might be when ESG is sort of taken as a given, and it's not worth separate discussion. It's just something that everyone has to do. At that point, how would you view your role? Is that just finding those new measures of ESG, or at what point do you consider success sort of working your model out of relevance, for lack of a more articulate way of saying it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's also a very good question. I think we've, what we find in private equity is that, you continuously need to renew yourself and find new angles and new areas of value creation. I think it'd be fantastic if every investor in the world actually invests with the planet in mind when they're investing and trying to create a financial return as well, which I think we all agree is important. I think that's going to be great. What we need to then do is continue to up our game, both in that area and in every other area that's important for private equity, choosing the right company, choosing the right people to lead the business, having an ambitious value creation plan, driving transformation in other ways. Business is not a static. It's not, there's always dynamic elements that are impacting business. And digitalization is one. We thought we were really good at digitalization. We are quite good at digitalization, actually. We have a digital team. We have an artificial intelligence unit with 17 data scientists that are working with us on finding investments and finding add-on acquisitions, those kinds of things. But we're not near integrating AI into everything we do. We're not near having all of our companies be on a super modern digital platform, et cetera. So there are multiple value creation paths. And I think the key is, though, is to invest with people who can see what those are and develop those and choose companies that can be impacted in a positive way and then ultimately drive returns that way. That's how I would think about it.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yes, Chair Russell, this is Monica Enand. I was really encouraged to see what you're doing in terms of gender diversity at EQT. And I was wondering if you would share with us if you have, we know that the juicy goodness of diversity really comes when we have inclusive cultures. And then, so if you have any best practices or things you've learned about creating inclusive cultures and as well on pay equity, or if you're doing anything in terms of KPIs around pay equity.
Yeah. Maybe one of my colleagues wants to talk about, for example, the Women's International Network. And I can kind of introduce it, but it's a now look. I think Anna is getting off mute to go there, but I think we've internally generated a lot of great initiatives to help drive inclusiveness and awareness of the importance of diversity and in performance and in having a good culture and everything. And that's a really great one, and I thought Anna was involved in it, so that's a really cool one. So let's give that example, maybe.
I can chime in on WIN, our Women's International Network, given that I'm one of the core sponsors, but really, you know, it started with a couple of our investment professionals at AQT that wanted to make sure that there's an environment and a forum to really promote women, not only in terms of recruiting, but also making sure that we have resources and adhering to retain, you know, really strong talent. Because I think that's a big part of the challenge. And so they've actually embarked on a number of initiatives, and many of which have been improved, more flexible work from home schedules, better parental leave policies, both for women and men, but also mentoring. We've continued this mentorship program, and it's because of a very resounding response. And it's not just women mentoring women, but it's senior leaders of the firm, Chris mentoring, you know, some of our associates from infrastructure, but really creating an environment that's supportive. We're also continuing to roll out this fall conscious inclusion training. We have a number of our very prominent EQT advisors that are women, Sharon McCoy for one that Chris mentioned, speaking to us in the different offices. So it's very much a lot more, I'd say, nurturing environment, and I think that's made a very positive impact. But there's also more to be done. You know, we've also, even at our investor, New York Investor Day and other annual meetings, Chris has been on panels really, you know, getting insights from some of our key investors and top female professionals at those organizations, and really trying to get their insights, but just really being more open and vocal about it, I think is helpful.
And I can just add in there, I think it's a really strong collaboration between the HR and also the WIN network, so collaborating there and finding new ways to improve on diversity. I think I can just say from my own perspective, the mentorship program that we have rolled out is one of the best mentor programs that I have seen. I have Thomas and Koch as mentor, and we're continuing now for the second year in this mentor program, and I know that it's hugely appreciated from the rest of the organization. And I think there are a number of different topics there, and happy to share more details on it separately or catch up on it.
No, that's great. I'm really happy to hear about the Conscious Inclusion Program. That sounds really wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. Happy to share more intel at your convenience.
Any other questions? If not, it's John Russell. I have a question about time. Like EQT, we're a perpetual entity. But this is the U.S. and we're evaluated every minute, every quarter, every year by the press. There's compensation based on returns, something less than perpetual. And I want to follow up on Treasurer Reed's question about the 15-year time frame for some of your investments and how they differ. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, thanks for the question. That strategy, we actually haven't started yet. We're about to embark on it. And the reason we're doing that is that we find that there are some industries that where we believe it'll take longer to create value and longer to drive that systemic change but you can do that for a long time and continue to create value for the investment. So, for example, we own, well, one of the examples working right now actually is we own a pest control company, which is now a $5 billion company or something like this. And that industry is, you know, we've driven it from a $500 million company or something. That's what's much, much bigger than we bought it. We've driven digitalization into it, which is sustainable by nature. So instead of driving around, you use electronic sensors and things. And instead of using damaging chemicals, we use natural chemicals and these elements. But both of those initiatives are still just, let's say, 15% on the way or maybe 10% on the way of penetration globally. So there's another maybe 15 years to drive that penetration, driving change across the world in that industry. And so we're trying to build now a fund which can find those types of opportunities and drive that kind of change harder, that we, you know, real impact over the longer term. And that, I think, is going to be really, really interesting. But I don't think the private equity model is broken, not at all. Actually, I think the 3 to 5 year kind of time frame and the energy you get out of that and the drive in the way that we invest and change companies during that time is actually quite exciting and quite energetic and important. But there are, you know, there are certain areas in the business world where we think we'd have another tool which takes a little bit longer to implement but can be equally good over time. So I'm happy to discuss that more actually with the investment team as we get closer and so we can sharpen the pencil. But this is our current idea.
The 15 year is not a fund that exists. It's something you contemplate. And yep. If so, where would you expect the demand to be?
We expect it to be from, limited partners and investors like yourself and many others, because many of our many of the investors in EQT have incredibly long dated obligations, and then have an ability to commit capital for the longer term. Not everybody has that mandate. We haven't spoken with any LPs about it. So you're kind of one of the first who's hearing about it, actually. But we have gotten feedback that a number of our family office investors and other institutional investors would like to be in an investment strategy that is longer, and that, you know, compounds capital for the longer term, has less transactional elements around it. And we're trying to think about, you know, our investment strategy, how we could design a long-term fund which can meet that investment strategy, basically.
So, Chair Russell, there are other precedents. This wouldn't be the first of its kind. I think there is demand, as Chris mentioned, by some other pension funds that do have long-term obligations. It's not unique to private equity. There are many infrastructure funds that are open-ended, where they take the view of holding longer or assets for the longer term in the infrastructure space. So, something that is a consideration, but nothing as of yet. Are there other questions?
Hearing none, on behalf of the staff and the council, thank you very, very much for taking the time to illuminate us on this very important topic. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the partnership.
Thank you.
So, Anna, you're on for the next topic, investment beliefs.
Okay, thank you. Good morning. For the record, I'm Anna Totdahl, Investment Officer of ESG and Sustainability. I'd like to request that the Council approve changes to the Statement of Investment Beliefs, including the addition of belief number 8, the introduction of language referencing the consideration of ESG factors in our decision making. We'll hold off on the vote until we've had a chance for some discussion from our consultants. I'd like to introduce Alan Emken first from Makita to speak to some of the history of the document and ESG, and then we'll hear from Janet Beckerwald from Callan for comments on the implementation they've seen elsewhere before we move to the vote. Alan?
Hi, Anna. Hello, everyone. I just want to make sure you can hear me.
Yep.
Yes.
Great. Thank you. That presentation is a pretty hard act to follow on this topic, but I think that it's a perfect transition for you to hear first from practitioners and how they implement it to you and your role as policymakers and how to incorporate those types of concepts into your belief statement. First and foremost, it's important to keep in mind that your investment beliefs are, in our opinion, and I think currently in the industry's opinion, best practice. Having investment beliefs provides a foundational component for the investment portfolio to assist in the oversight and management of the assets. It basically provides the macro or top-down view on implementing policy. The OIC went through a lengthy and detailed process to adopt the investment beliefs, and there was significant discussion, debate, and in fact it was an evolving dynamic process, not a static one. The key components of the investment beliefs addressed governance, diversification, the equity risk premium, and that you'll be rewarded for taking equity risk, especially for Oregon, given your history, the importance of private markets and their ability to add value, that there are, in fact, inefficiencies in the capital markets, and they can be taken advantage of, but it's not easy. If it was easy to beat the market, everyone would do it, and that's clearly not the case. A focus on costs, and particularly in the challenging environment we're in, it's really crucial to focus on costs, that having fair and efficient capital markets are essential. And that's taken for granted, I think, sometimes, but there are parts in the world where the markets aren't fair and efficient, and that's why having them fair and efficient for large institutional investors is so important. A concept that diversity adds value, crucial, and that was underscored during the presentation that you just had. But as risk metrics evolve, risk factors associated with diversity and other ESG factors will be adopted by more and more institutional investors. And very importantly, that the investment beliefs are dynamic. They're not static, and they will be amended over time to reflect the changes in the council, the changes in the capital markets, and the changes in information, crucial. I have, as most of you know, a lot of history with the Oregon Investment Council. My initial involvement was in 1984 on the issue of South African divestment. At that point, Roger Meyer, who was a visionary, was the chair, and there was a small staff of less than five people, but they were committed. Yeah, that's true. less than five people. But they were really good, and they were very thoughtful, and they were innovative. And under Roger's leadership, they undertook decisions that were really brave and very, very futuristic, specifically the adoption and incorporation of private equity is truly one of the first movers. The OIC was then and continues to be a thought leader and has evidenced a willingness and a commitment to be innovative and creative. In the early 80s, that was reflected by the private equity and real estate commitments. After the global financial crisis, it was reflected by the opportunistic move into heavily discounted bank loans, which turned out to be an enormously successful transaction. And in the last few years, seeking fundamental diversification, not by what the title of an asset says, but what it does in terms of risk and return. And many of you will remember the analogy of the previous CIO about the rock band, and it's important to have in a band people playing different instruments and having different roles, and that's true diversification, not just diversification in name. Particularly in the last few years, there's been a focus on risk management, and that has risen to a priority with the adoption and use of the Aladdin tool and dramatically growing the staff and the resources and the information provided to the council on risk and its importance. What's really important to keep in mind is the adoption of the investment beliefs. Yes, it's best practice, but historically, many of these concepts were embedded in the investment policy statement or in the practices. They just were not reflected in a single document. The investment belief statement provides a concise and clear statement of the council's belief of what will really be important in the management of the investment portfolio. And it's a statement that's not just for the council and the staff, but for policymakers and for stakeholders, so they know what is driving the decision-making on a huge amount of capital, which is really important to the state. The action around ESG, it's important not to lose focus. And as the previous speaker's presentation reflected, the key here is data and analysis and recognizing that it has an enormous impact over time on the risk and return of the investment portfolio. And so I'm going to read to you from a recent article from the CFA Institute, which states that the CFA Institute consistently monitors key debates and evolving issues in the investment industry. ESG investing and analysis become of increasing interest to investment professionals globally as governments, asset owners, and high net worth investors consider the impact of ESG factors on investments and local markets. We believe, and that's the CFA Institute, more thorough consideration of ESG factors by financial professionals can improve the fundamental analysis they undertake and ultimately the investment choices they make, Alan Emkin now talking, which result in better risk-adjusted returns. So, what sets the OIC apart from its peers? In my opinion, nothing more so than the history of the board's involvement, the board's willingness to address issues and developing and building a staff from that handful of people in 1984 to 80 strong and growing with deep knowledge, deep expertise, and a shared vision. There's been a continuity of ideology over all that time. Always the desire has been for the highest risk-adjusted return and a recognition that there are values that need to be embedded in the investment decision-making process. The council has consistently supported the staff and has evidenced a willingness to be innovative and creative, and that's now reflected in an extraordinarily well-diversified portfolio with world-class staff, and that's reflected in extraordinarily good historic rates of return on both an absolute and a relative basis. It's important to keep in mind that the ESG beliefs are the beginning of the investment decision-making process. They're meaningless unless they're implemented, and that requires policies and procedures, metrics, reporting, and the willingness to amend things and be dynamic as people change. There is no silver bullet or single form of best practice in ESG integration. And once again, I'm quoting from the CFA, investors should focus on ESG analysis rather than ESG investing as a fundamental component of investment analysis because it requires a disciplined, data-driven approach to be fully integrated into the investment decision-making process. And that's why this belief is so important, because if it's implemented and it's disciplined across asset classes at every level, it has the potential of increasing the risk-adjusted rate of return of the portfolio. Mr. Chair, that's my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just a question, Alan, from John Russell. My recollection of our earlier discussion this morning is that you were unhappy that you're not visible on the screen because you wore a tie. If that's true, we're happy to stipulate that you did.
Well, thank you for that. And what I might do is, with your permission, I'll send a picture to you that can be distributed so that people will feel, you know, that they didn't miss anything.
I do have a serious question, and maybe you and Anna can answer it. Tell me about PRI. My understanding, it came up in the EQT presentation. My understanding is that we are not currently members.
I'll defer to Anna.
Yeah. So PRI, as EQT mentioned, is probably the preeminent resource in terms of ESG investing on a global basis. A lot of our managers are PRI signatories. And that is something that we look to as sort of an indicator or one of the best practices with respect to ESG. We are not ourselves currently a signatory to the PRI, and there are a number of reasons for that. We do maintain really good relationships with the PRI and use their resources extensively. They make a lot of things available for free to asset owners and various constituents.
Well, clearly that's not a decision the council is authorized to make, but thank you.
And if there's anything else, I'm happy to address it, whether it's the history or what other people are doing. But the adoption of principles, investment beliefs, with a recognition that the risk and return associated with these factors is no longer viewed as something unusual. It's completely mainstream. But it's going to be an evolution and not a revolution, and as more data and better analytical tools present themselves, these types of considerations will be more important in the investment decision-making process.
Should I add on to this at this point, or, Alan, do you have more that you'd like to add?
No, I'm done. My tie's still on.
All right, well, in this discussion, I think my focus is going to be on highlighting a few issues that are kind of real time in terms of regulatory and sort of government regulation, and then talk about a few clients that we've worked with and a survey that we've conducted on how institutional investors are looking at incorporating ESG factors into their investment beliefs, investment policy statements, and guidelines. So a couple of things I'm sure you are all aware of is that Illinois passed the Sustainable Investing Act in 2019, which laid down some very specific requirements for public funds within the state. And that was kind of new, although Illinois has done that before on issues of diversity in regards to investment managers, pension staff, and brokers. So this is a step now into a sustainable investing where they have already passed regulation for diversity. So they have to now publish and develop sustainable investment policies and incorporate them actively into their selection of investment managers and the determination of their investment policies. So that was the most direct thing we've seen a state actually do. Of course, the DOL keeps weighing in as well. They have kind of changed their guidance over time. Initially, it was really related to being a focus on performance and not really looking at ESG issues too much. Then they kind of evolved that into you could consider non-economic factors as long as they were pari passu with the investment issues. Then it was sort of an all things being equal policy. And the new rule that they're proposing would be much more limiting in terms of the way fiduciaries can incorporate what they consider to be non-economic factors, and they highlighted ESG considerations as a primary focus. Their statements were fairly broad and bold in regards to their criticism of the actual metrics used on ESG. Their concern is that incorporating them into defined contribution plans, for example, could increase costs and that there's no proven metrics that it adds value. So there's a lot of controversy around this new rule and a lot of pensions, corporate defined contribution plans, et cetera, have weighed in. And the overwhelming response, at least to date, since the rule has been posted and comments have been open, is that it's been relatively negative. That many believe that it is very important to include ESG considerations and investments, as Alan just kind of highlighted. So looking at kind of if you look at our recent survey, we asked a lot of questions regarding how are U.S. institutional investors looking at ESG and have they incorporated ESG into their investment decisions. We've been doing this survey since 2013. Our most recent survey was conducted in 2019. And what you can see kind of over that time period from the beginning of our survey till now, and this incorporates 89 institutional investors with a pretty broad representation from public funds, corporate funds, and nonprofits, exclusively U.S.-based, however. There are other surveys that have incorporated European investors as well, and the Europeans have, as we just heard from the previous presentation, have had a much higher uptake much earlier on ESG-related issues than we have in the U.S., and part of it is this sort of challenge on these fiduciary issues that have, I think, held back U.S. institutional investors in terms of really going all in on ESG. But the encouraging news for ESG adoption is that it's becoming more common, and the amount of investors that said no, they're not considering it, has really declined fairly substantially from the initial survey back in 2013. And the group that has the highest adoption or are in the process of adopting were, no surprise, endowments, and then public funds, then foundations, and then corporations. And then when we kind of asked them about why they were adopting these, kind of what were their top reasons, the first one for positive adoption was fiduciary responsibility. The second was to better align their portfolios with their organization's values. The third was pressure or concerns coming out of their stakeholders and or board members, employees, or advocacy groups. The other one was risk profile, to improve the risk profile. So there's a number of reasons why we've seen institutional investors kind of adopt this, and they're making it a higher priority. So looking at some work that we did recently for the New York City Employees Retirement Plan, they took a different approach and were very direct in their investment policy statements and their investment beliefs, saying that they felt an obligation as a long-term universal investor to advocate for governance, social issues, and the environment. So this was a pretty clear statement of responsibility. And they made some other statements that were pretty direct as well, that they prefer ESG to be taken into account, and they believe it has a material effect on increasing value and reducing risk for their members and their beneficiaries. So these are pretty bold statements that we hadn't really seen. We had seen softer language in a lot of investment policy statements or investment beliefs, but evolving now, by evidenced by New York City employees, is a much more direct statement of responsibility and obligation to consider these things and take them into account when making investment decisions. So I thought that was kind of an interesting shift. If you look at, for example, the University of California, they have a focus primarily on sustainability. And they made a statement that it is a fundamental concern that we incorporate our decision-making, incorporate it into the decision-making, and find out how we can improve both the risk and the performance of the fund. So they kind of put their arms around both the risk, which has been the more preferred route, is to use ESG-related factors as a way to mitigate risk. But they also made a very strong statement about sustainability and how that it was not an obligation but a responsibility of the organization. So we're seeing the language really shift here from softer risk control to more direct statements of responsibility. And you see more public funds signing on as UNPRI signatories. Makita may be one. I know that Callan is. We signed it a year or so ago. It does come with a list of things that you are supposed to do, and it does have some fairly specific sustainability guidelines. So we are seeing this really become more of a topic of conversation, and as Alan mentioned in his comments, we're seeing more people take direct action. These things have been talked about for a long time. I think people were reticent to go into them very directly or make direct statements like we're seeing now in New York and take the softer side. But now I think given climate change issues and other sort of shift in sentiment, if you will, by investors broadly and their beneficiary and their constituents, that this is becoming much more acceptable to take a much more direct approach. So Europe has been on this for quite some time. The Dutch pension fund also in their statement of investment beliefs made some pretty direct statements about sustainability, governance, and human resource issues. So again, the Europeans are a little ahead of us here, but the environmental piece and the social piece are starting to take on more conversation, more direct policy implications than the governance, which has been around for quite some time. I think everybody realized and felt comfortable with the measurement metrics of the value add of governance. So I'll just stop there and see if there's any questions or if we can facilitate an additional discussion.
Any questions of Anna, Janet, or Alan? Hearing none. Anna, is there a staff recommendation?
There is. The staff recommends the inclusion of statement number 8, the integration of environmental, social, and governance factors. Into the investment beliefs, as well as additional minor modifications to investment belief number 7.
Do I hear a motion to approve the staff recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to make that motion, but I do want to make a couple points, or maybe one specific, and then we'll go to discussion, I assume, after the motion is made. I may be the only one who was confused initially when I was reading number 8 by the inclusion of environmental factors and social factors, but the absence of governance factors or reference to it. That, in fact, is incorporated in number 7, but I wanted to make sure that no one else had the difficulty that I did. So I think that that was very helpful to me to get that clarified. So with that, I'm happy to move the recommendation and the adoption of the changes to the investment beliefs.
It's been moved. Is there a second? I'm happy to second it. It's been seconded by Patty. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, before we move on, I just want to acknowledge the work that's gone into this. I might have said that before. I thought we might have gone into discussion before the vote. So let me just say thanks to Anna, to Rex, to Alan, to Janet, to everybody else who's been involved in this. It's a significant step, I think, for the council and for the state. Also really acknowledge that it's the beginning of the effort, and we will have a lot more conversation about how the implementation will actually go. It's one thing to make the statement. It's significant, but the proof will really be in how we integrate and implement our commitment to these factors. And I especially appreciate the point that Janet made about this being a risk factor but also a performance opportunity. So I'm sure there are others who have things to add, but I wanted to make sure that people recognize this is a significant thing, and I'm really grateful for all the work that's gone into it.
Thank you. I'm remiss in not calling for discussion. But
fine.
Terrific. Thank you all. And the next item on the agenda is Jeff Nolan on the fixed income recommendation.
Hey, good morning, Chair Russell, Treasurer Reid, members of the board. For the record, I'm Jeff Nolan, Senior Investment Officer of Fixed Income. Today's presentation is going to be a much shortened version of what we did in June, the OIC presentation, as we won't need to go through all of the detailed background material again, which I've actually put in the appendix for your reference. But briefly, to remind folks on the council and others listening in December of 2019, a realignment of the fixed income portfolio was approved, which allowed for a further de-risking. This would be the third one of the portfolio to more closely align it with the goals of the fixed income portfolio, which in summary, our diversification to the overall equity risk, but in particular to the public equities, and providing liquidity to meet OPIR cash flow needs. This recommendation today, which is up for your approval, is a continuation of the manager searches that the fixed income staff has been undertaking beginning a couple of months ago. Today, I'm not going to actually page flip through the manager overviews, as they're pretty self-explanatory, and you have a lot more details from the staff memos as well as the Callan memos as to our review process, and those are included in your packets. As I mentioned, this is going to be a very shortened version, so I'm going to go right to the fixed income staff recommendation for your approval to hire Guggenheim, Schroders, and Putnam for a structured products mandate to manage up to 12.8% of the fixed income AUM to be split equally. So with that, I will open it up for any questions that you may have. If there are none, then I'd move for recommendation to hire the three managers.
Thank you, Jeff. It's actually my obligation to call for a motion. But
oh, my apologies.
Any questions of Jeff? Hearing none, is there a motion to?
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the shortened presentation. We did hear a lot, and I'm glad to see it back. I'm happy to move the staff recommendation as presented.
Is there a second? I'm happy to second it. Discussion? If not, let's call for a vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. And I'm voting nay. So, but the motion passes. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much. Take care now.
And let's take a break for 5 minutes and get back at 10:45. So it's 10:45. We're back in session. Let me call the meeting back to order. Ben Mahon, you're on.
Great.
And Ben, excuse me, before you start, Rex told me that you are the person to whom we should credit the introduction to EQT. Is that the case?
That is indeed the case.
Well, thank you.
Very impressive.
Absolutely. And I guess, good morning, and thank you, Chair Russell. I will start with the obligatory sound check. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. So under discussion is the Alternatives Portfolio Annual Review and Plan. And for the record, I'm Ben Mahon, Senior Investment Officer for the Alternatives Portfolio, and I'm joined virtually by the portfolio's two consultants, on one side by Tom Martin with Axia Torrey Cove. Axia assists with the real assets allocation, i.e. the infrastructure and natural resources, and on the other side by Jim Callahan with Callan. Callan assists with the diversifying strategies allocation. Per usual, I don't plan to address every slide in the deck, but do have a few key topics to highlight, which will hopefully leave you with a sense for where we've been, where we are, and where we're going, and the whys behind all that. And, of course, we're prepared to pivot as necessary and happy to answer any questions, so please don't hesitate to ask away. Starting on slide 2 in the executive summary, and I will expand on all these on future slides, but the bullet points roughly correspond to the 4 main themes for the portfolio and for the presentation, and that's role, stage, resource growth, and market opportunity. And they're not numbered, but if the bullets were numbered, 1, 2, and 4 really differentiate the alts portfolio from the other OPRF portfolios. So beginning with role, as you've heard me say before, the primary objective of the alternatives portfolio is to provide a source of diversification for OPRF, and that's through seeking less correlated and diversifying sources of returns as well as inflation-sensitive returns. And some subsequent slides will explore the why and the how of this. Second, in terms of stage, the alts portfolio is early in its build-out, and the characteristics reflect the stage of development. And you know, this is a function of creating and scaling a new portfolio, as well as an increasing target allocation, which has grown from 5% at inception to 15% today. So as a result, about half of total commitments and capital contributions have been made in the past 3 years. So still a young portfolio with a weighted average age around 3 years. Third, but most importantly, is resource growth. And it's reflective of the growth at OST overall. But the alts portfolio has grown from a team of 1 in 2014 to a team of 5 today. And that's highlighted by 2 recent changes with Amanda Kingsbury's promotion from alts portfolio investment analyst to investment officer almost a year ago to the day. And more recently, effective September 1st, Ian Huckelack promotion from investment analyst from the operations group. Ian joined OST in June 2019. And during his time in operations, he served as a back and middle office resource for the ALTS program, and as a result knows our processes, investment strategies, and external managers well. In addition, he's a freshly minted CFA charter holder, so very excited to be able to add him to our team. And the last thing to note is just in terms of market, I would just reiterate that it's a dynamic market with an evolving opportunity set. Relative to OPRF's other portfolios, the alternatives asset class is the least defined, so a lot of first- and second-time funds, as well as a number of first-of-their-kind funds. So next slide goes into a bit more detail.
Ben, go ahead. John Russell, on that topic, I think what I hear you saying is that because of its youth and because investments are long-term, that the monthly and quarterly returns aren't directly applicable. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. No, definitely a longer-term asset class. And, you know, I think maybe more specifically to your point, it is still very much in build-out mode. And so when we look at, you know, the J-curve or the cash flow you know, typically, or I guess across all private equity, that kind of the depth of that J curve, that maximum cash outflow, is between years 3 and 4. So we really are, you know, in that, you know, kind of in that valley there. If that, hopefully that addresses your question. So on slide 3, under real assets, you know, in the context of performance, it's been a bit a tale of two asset classes. For natural resources, by design, there is exposure to commodities and commodity prices, and this has served as a headwind for the portfolio. For example, over the past 2 years, the GSCI index, which is a measure of the commodity market, has declined 35% cumulatively. For infrastructure, performance has been better, and it's a reflection of the diversity of the asset class as well as the nature of the cash flows, where you have the presence of contracted revenues as well as some inelastic demand patterns. And frankly, we've also had some sectors expected to benefit from COVID, namely internet infrastructure. And on that, on the sub-bullet point, I think it's reasonable, we believe it's reasonable to conclude that strong performance will provide further momentum for the asset class's growth. Regarding co-investment, it's been an area of focus for the past few years, but now with the anchor relationships in place and analysis completed, we have clarity around our implementation strategy. Under diversifying strategies, there's a bit of an analog to commodities and natural resources with equity value and diversifying strategies, and it's the same story for the public equity portfolio. The magnitude of values under performance has been a real drag. For example, year to date through the end of August, the Russell 3000 value has underperformed the Russell 3000 growth by 40%, 40. For the diversifying strategies portfolio overall, the story of the past 4 years has been continued evolution. With the allocation increase in April 2019, the portfolio analysis related to the next phase of development of the portfolio, what we term DSP 3.0, continues. And to assist with that evaluation and in recognition of the growth in allocation, we thought it was prudent to add additional resources and expertise through a dedicated consultant. And that search is underway and will hopefully result in a recommendation for the OIC to consider at the October meeting. Finally, there's a single action item. Staff and consultant are recommending eliminating the real asset subsector target weightings and proceeding with an overall 7.5% real asset allocation, inclusive of infrastructure and natural resources strategies. And again, I will delve into all these on subsequent slides. So if we can jump ahead to slide 5 in the timeline, and I have a tendency to get pretty into the weeds pretty quickly. So what I'd like to do with this overview section is zoom out for a higher level perspective, and I start here with an abbreviated timeline. And there's two things to note on this slide. The first is the genesis and the growth of the allocation, and the second is the growth of team headcount. And I call that out on these boxes. But again, just you know, emblematic of the growth of Treasury, what was a team of one, a team of five today. You know, the discussions around the creation of the alternatives portfolio started in earnest in 2010 and were in response to the global financial crisis and in recognition that OPIF performance was highly tied to equity market performance. For example, at the depths of the GFC, OPIF was down 35%. Versus the S&P 500 down 47%. Thus, the OIC sought to introduce assets and strategies to dampen that volatility. And I think, you know, diversification is obviously understood by everyone on this call, but it's especially important for pensions, where the goal is to maximize funded status and where protecting from a drawdown in the presence of cash flow, of negative cash flow, is especially important. The next slide provides slide 6 provides some additional background on the alternatives portfolio, and just a few things to highlight here. You know, as noted, the portfolio was seeded July 1st, 2011, with three investments from the opportunity portfolio, so nearing the 10th anniversary. Also of note, and consistent with the expansion potential outlined in the original proposal, the target allocation for the portfolio has increased 3 times since inception, from an initial allocation of 5% to 15% today. And lastly, as shown in the pie chart, the portfolio is comprised of 3 sectors, and it's a bit of a potpourri, but on one half, you have real assets, and that's the infrastructure and natural resources allocation, and on the other half, you have diversifying strategies. The next slide, slide 7, you know, I included a screenshot from the initial recommendation presentation, and this was just meant to highlight that in terms of the objectives, diversification has always been at the center of the mandate, that these things have all remained consistent. The next slide, slide 8, I summarize as the how of the diversification. You know, in general, we're targeting assets and strategies with different sources of return and with different macroeconomic sensitivities. And a recent shining example of this is data or internet infrastructure, you know, which I think we would all agree is essential. And with greater internet usage, with increasing data traffic, data infrastructure needs continue to grow in ways largely uncorrelated to macroeconomic trends. And with these assets, you also typically see contracted cash flow with multi-year availability-based contracts providing monthly recurring revenue. The customers are often highly creditworthy, such as government agencies, wireless carriers, or large medium enterprises. And even, you know, the businesses serving retail customer bases, you know, provide a utility-type service. You also see barriers to entry with locational, contractual, or regulatory barriers, which makes the assets difficult to replicate or replace. So again, that's one, you know, positive example. Certainly, there have been other sectors of infrastructure that have fared less well. Anything with a passenger transportation element, you know, has faced some headwinds, but hopefully that gives you a sense of what we're looking to achieve with the portfolio. The next slide, page 9, summarizes the commitments and market value history, so a bit of where we've been and where we are. And I would just draw your attention to the 2 lines. The first is the dotted line, which represents the alts portfolio target allocation. And the second is the solid line, which represents the alts portfolio actual allocation. And I guess just the thing to note here is that the first increase occurred relatively early in the portfolio's life cycle, and as evidenced by the light gray bars, you know, it's really been, you know, post 2015, and really the last 3 years where you've seen the majority of the commitments. So as the portfolio has matured, have ramped up those commitments. That is already a lot. That was just the overview. So before I press forward with the real assets update, are there any questions or any other issues I can address?
Questions have been?
Well, then I will press forward. If you move to slide 14, these are the basically snapshot of the last 18 months, summarizing the approvals from 2019 and year-to-date 2020. And in terms of investment activity, the last 18 months have been busy with $1.9 billion in commitments across 10 investments. We also highlight in that second bullet point some successes in terms of fee concessions. You know, this is something we obviously view as a priority and look to capture the benefit when we can. The fees are obviously one part of the evaluation equation, not the sole metric, but you know, these small wins equate to some real dollars. So just applying the management fee discount to the first year of the investment period of these funds translates to an aggregate $2.5 million of savings. So continue to work to structure, you know, better deals for OPERF. I will jump ahead to page 16. And this is the performance review for the real assets portfolio. As noted in the first bullet point, you know, the portfolio is still in its early years, and as a result, hard to extract any meaningful conclusions. As noted in the executive summary, you know, the commodity exposure has been a headwind for the portfolio, for the natural resources sector in particular. And the following slide, slide 17, covers this in a bit more depth. So when we evaluate the relative underperformance of commodities the past decade, we ask ourselves, have we been in an environment where commodities typically thrive? And the short answer in our view is no. While commodities have historically outperformed during periods of rising inflation, you know, the inverse is also true. They've typically lagged during periods of stable or falling inflation. And they've, I think importantly, commodities have maintained a tight relationship with inflation expectations over the past decade, yet this high inflation correlation has been a headwind for the asset class amid the ongoing deflationary environment. At the same time, what's been a lost decade for commodities has driven capital spending across natural resources to low levels, and that creates a risk of undersupply over the next few years. Looking ahead, we see attractive asset valuations and supply-demand deficits that give us reason to believe that we could see commodity price appreciation going forward. And I think collectively believe that there will be interesting things to do. The next slide just provides some data behind some of my earlier comments, relative to... Yes?
John Russell again, if I may.
Of course.
Commodities are obviously a very, very broad topic. Not all commodities have fared badly. But do we have managers who aren't specialized in copper or whatever and would be able to make investments in time with different commodities?
Yes, and that is, part of the portfolio construction is it's a bit of a puzzle, putting the different exposures together. But that's been the bright spot in the natural resources allocation has been our metals and mining exposure. And that spans precious metals, industrial metals, base metals, and across geographies. So from South America to Sub-Saharan Africa. What's reflected here in the GSCI, the heaviest weighting there is to energy. And so that has definitely has kind of led the way down, as I think as we're all familiar with. So hopefully that provided an adequate response.
Well, our managers are free to invest in lithium or something like that rather than copper or steel or...
Exactly. Some more of those rare earths and other... it's again. I think the majority would be in the larger metals, just given the investability. But we see exposure across all those.
Thank you.
I'll move to slide 19, and these are our priorities. And I'll just two things to highlight, and given it's already September, I can have a fair degree of confidence when I say that the 2020 commitment pacing is on track. If you include everything in the pipeline currently that's advancing in the pipeline, we'll settle right in the middle of these expectations in line with the annual pacing budget. And the other thing to note, it's under number three, is ESG, and piggybacking off of some of the EQT comments, I think it's around the investment beliefs discussion, just to note that it is it's part of our process today, and it's has been formally part of our process. We have a cross asset class working group, our ESG champions working with Anna to improve that, and so that we continue to I think make good progress there, but I guess the message I'd want to convey is that we hear you on the on the topic, and we're working on it, and with your direction, pressing forward. The under real assets, there's two final topics. So page 20, historically co-investment has not been a feature of our program, and our mindset was, it's the most important thing is that you establish those anchor relationships, and then once you have those pieces in place, then you evaluate implementation, and the results of that evaluation are summarized here. So going forward, we're looking to build a portfolio of co-investment sidecars, and these are vehicles that invest alongside the main funds. So envisioning a program where 10 to 20% of the real asset portfolio commitments come via co-investment. These sidecar vehicles will be contemplated as part of the primary fund recommendation, or I guess with the primary fund recommendation, or under staff authority. So it is a slightly different implementation than private equity, what they've pursued with Pathway, but it's the identical goals. It's to minimize that fee drag and to get exposure to as many deals as possible to replicate the exposures. So the next slide, next two slides, 21 and 22, summarize the real asset sector weighting recommendation. And again, just to repeat myself, in short, the staff and consultant are recommending eliminating the target sector weightings and proceeding with an overall 7.5% real assets allocation, inclusive of infrastructure and natural resources strategies. And I would just highlight two things from this. The first is just a recognition that the infrastructure market has grown significantly since the portfolio's inception, and we've been just consistently seeing more opportunities in line with our mandate. So, the quantity and quality of options, have just been more consistent in infrastructure. And the second thing I note is, in the category of real assets, you're often definitionally in a gray area. So even if it's a classic infrastructure investment, there's often some natural resources exposure. And that could, be if it's – and I use an example here of midstream agriculture where you're – it's basically everything, from the farm to the table. You're very dependent on the number of acres planted, commodity prices, et cetera. So even if it is classically – an infrastructure investment, you're still, impacted by the natural resources market. And so I think what we will continue to pursue opportunities in natural resources. This, I think, just provides more latitude in how we implement. And I will, at the end, kind of conclude with a recommendation. But is there any questions either on this recommendation or on the real assets portfolio in general?
Questions from Ben? Ben?
Yeah. Ben, this is Tobias. I'm just wondering if I'm understanding you correctly, that the flexibility that the recommendation would give you is separate from sort of the intention. So the intention is consistent, just allows you to take advantage of how the market is changing. It doesn't represent a change in how you want to approach this portion. Is that right?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Go ahead, Ben.
Sure. So I will jump to page 24. And now entering the land of diversifying strategies. And just to reiterate, that the diversifying strategies nomenclature we use is intentional, and it stems from the focus on diversification. And it also, in contrast to a traditional hedge fund portfolio, it speaks to the key characteristics we're targeting. So it's a preference for strategies with lower fees, with better transparency, with greater liquidity and greater capacity. The next slide, slide 25, shows how the portfolio has evolved. And through 2016, there was effectively only one manager, AQR. And as the target allocation, as the actual allocation grew, we focused on expanding and diversifying the manager roster and strategies of interest, which is what we term the 2.0 era. And now with the most recent allocation increase, we're undertaking a similar exercise. And as part of that analysis, we plan to hire a dedicated consultant to help us evaluate. And we'll I'll touch on that too in a moment in greater detail. The next slide, slide 26, just summarizes the approvals from 2019 and year-to-date 2020. You know, in terms of activity, the past 18 months have been largely focused on completing the 2.0 with the addition of the global macro sub-strategy via Bridgewater and GMO and the third managed features manager, Fort. I think future recommendations are in a holding pattern until we get that consultant input. Slide 27 addresses performance. You know, as noted, performance over the past 2 years in particular has been disappointing, and equity value explains virtually all of this. Again, that disparity between growth and value has been extreme, and in an implementation that's long short and that utilizes leverage, we are getting a bit of a double whammy from that. You know, I think maybe I'll jump to the next page, if that's okay, page 28. And it's just to highlight that, you know, these factors, these risk factors in particular, you know, well-researched, empirically tested, but have seen times when it doesn't work. And that's why I always make this comment that their risk premia, their compensation for risk, it's not just premia. And so you have to ride through these periods. And we don't believe by any extent it's permanently impaired. And in fact, the other risk premia that are being captured are performing fine and in line with what you would expect. You just see them in that chart, you know, the magnitude of the drawdown in line with the tech bubble and ultimately burst. The other thing to note, you know, since inception, you know, it has realized a very low correlation with OPERF. So, you know, while performance is disappointing, you know, on the other metrics, have achieved what we would hope to achieve. Let's see. So, page 29, next page, priorities for the next few months and beginning of next year, and it's number one there is the consultant search. We have our interviews tomorrow and Friday, so I'm very, very grateful for Kara, for member samples, and for her time serving as the OIC representative. But again, endeavor to provide a recommendation to the board in October. And I know that's been a whirlwind, but I will conclude on slide 31 and the key takeaways. You know, just to reiterate, the role of the portfolio remains unchanged, you know, focused on strategies that we believe are diversifying. In terms of stage, still young, but the development is on track. Continue to utilize and leverage the broader resources and the growing resources. Market opportunity remains dynamic and interesting. And the final item to highlight is the sector allocation changes. So happy, you know, if there were any, any kind of final thoughts or discussion around that. What's included here is recommended changes and related policy modifications.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question before we take up the recommendation?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Ben, I know you talked about this a little bit in your presentation, and I've just been reflecting on it since you said it and connecting to the conversation about ESG. One thing that occurs to me is to wonder how you begin to think about ESG given the really diverse nature of the things that are in the portfolio that you manage. I imagine ESG looks different in the context of commodities than it does in natural resources or real assets, and I wonder if you just had a 30-second takeaway for us to consider on that front.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, fundamentally what we're doing, you know, when we evaluate an investment, you know, typically a commitment in a fund, what we're doing is underwriting the risk. And we're asking ourselves, does the risk make sense and are we compensated for that risk? And so I think what we've done, consistently now the last 4 years is including a ranking scorecard in each of our underwritings and where we're asking those questions asking the questions of each other just to make sure that we understand and we come in, eyes wide open to those risks. And it is more, to your point, inputs to across the portfolio, inputs and factors that matter, but it seems to, tends to be more visible in real asset space where you're talking about power generation, you're talking about resource extraction. And so we continue to look for, ways to up our game and then also in our communications with our partners. So we use, I think, EQT, when we evaluate our GPs and kind of their progress on this front, EQT is the leader. But even they, I think it was Monica that asked about KPIs and what are you seeing, in terms of correlation between performance. And, the reality is it's been since 2015 that they've more formally started capturing these things. So, here you have, I think, a leader in the space, and they're still working their way up the learning curve. Any other questions or issues I can address?
Hearing none, and you're asking so there's a staff recommendation.
Correct. These are the changes we recommend and the related policy modifications.
Mr. Chair, I think if I made a compelling case, I'm happy to move the staff recommendation for these policy changes.
Been moved. Is there a second?
This is Monica. I second.
Been moved and seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 I think I heard unanimous vote, so thank you, Ben.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
That concludes the action item portion of the agenda. Quarter two performance.
Okay. I'm going to take the lead on this, and Jim will chime in when he has something to add. Rex, if you could please open our presentation to page 2. And since I don't have a live feed of the video, I have a delayed. I'm just going to hope that Rex and I are always on the same page. So this page shows the U.S. economy, sort of a summary. There are 4 charts across this page. And these are the ones we think frame the current environment fairly well. I mean, they're not comprehensive, of course, but growth, rates, and inflation are really important components of any investment program. So looking at the upper left, you can see the quarterly real GDP growth, and I apologize, I know we're in September and these numbers are probably well known to everyone. I think it's worth keeping them in mind as we frame the quarter and the fiscal year. So of course, GDP, the initial estimate of second quarter GDP was down 32.9%. It was revised slightly up to negative 31.7, but an incredibly weak number. And of course, this has a lot to do with consumer spending, which constitutes 70% of U.S. GDP. On the right-hand side, you can see what inflation has done, which is not much. The July numbers came out with headline CPI up 1 and core up 1.6. And some of that has to do with food costs, not food in restaurants, but food that we're buying. In fact, there was a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago that was talking about how inflation is understated right now based on the limited scope of the basket of goods that consumers are spending on, that the prices of that limited basket, which is not reflected in the calculation of the CPI-U, is much higher than this even 1% year-over-year July number would indicate, because the things we need and the things we want are difficult to find. Supply chains have been constrained. So we're seeing CPI really understated. If you look at the U.S. Treasury yield curve on the bottom left-hand side of this chart, the gold line is a year ago, June 30, 2019. The sort of teal-colored line is one quarter ago, so the end of the first quarter, and then the dark blue line is June, so the second quarter end. And what you can see here is those lines are just on top of each other. So rates really didn't do a whole lot in the quarter. They kind of went sideways, up and down, stayed in a pretty tight range. The 10-year today is at 69. It's been as high as 74, but I think we could all agree that that's extremely low and it's likely to stay that way for quite some time. The right-hand chart on the bottom of this page, the bottom right-hand corner, shows 10-year yields for the U.S. in dark blue, the TIPS yield, and the break-even inflation rate. And you can see here that investor expectations, as shown by the break-even rate, which is the teal line near the bottom, have dropped and are now negative. So the outlook is fairly sanguine, to say the best. I mean, I don't know what the next quarter will bring in terms of GDP, what the third quarter will look like. We have seen some states start to open. We've seen employment improve. The unemployment rate dropped to 8.4% in August. We saw job gains of 1.4 million. So, I mean, those are starting to make people feel a little more optimistic. However, when you read the headlines, significant layoffs have been announced by United, not surprisingly, dominated by airlines. United, Delta, Spirit, Boeing, and American have all announced tens of thousands, so 16,000 for United, 19,000 for American. So we may see another leg up in initial unemployment claims, and we may see a rise in the unemployment rate as some of these layoffs start to take place. They're scheduled to take place between now and the end of October, so we'll have to see how that goes.
If I may, back on inflation, to what degree is that influenced by the value of the U.S. dollar?
It is to the extent that export, if the dollar is very weak, import prices are higher in dollar terms. So there is an import-export component to CPI, but mostly this is U.S.-based demand for goods and services. And if you look in the way that CPI gets split, there's a different inflation number for goods than services. So services used to have pretty high inflation, and that's dropped pretty dramatically because there's just not a lot of demand. And there's not a lot of demand for goods, so inflation is relatively low. And the dollar has been strong, but it has been weakening lately. So it's kind of helped on our import prices.
Thank you.
Because we can buy them with a stronger dollar. That helps keep the cost down. The dollar declines, it makes the cost go up. Did that answer your question, John?
Yes. Yeah.
I can't see you, so I have to count on you being nodding your head. So if we could turn to page 3, I'm just going to spend a minute on this and hopefully give you a quick update on where we are closer to now. If you look at the last quarter ending June, which is the first column on this rather busy chart, you see the Russell 3000 index was up 22% for the quarter. And over the 10 years now, it's compounding at an average annual rate of 13.7%, so arguably incredibly strong markets for public equities. If you look at global ex-U.S. and you look at the world ex-U.S., which is the developed markets outside of the U.S., we've been at 15.3%. It's nothing to be disappointed in. However, it lags the U.S. market by, 7%. So in terms of the biases that Ben sort of alluded to within his presentation on alternatives, some of the biases in your portfolio that work against you is a consistent outperformance of the U.S. over the non-U.S., since you have essentially a global portfolio which equal weights those two components. And we're going to get to this when we look at the rankings for the total fund. Some of these have been headwinds, including the value orientation that Ben also noted, and that is the value growth disparity on all market capitalization ranges and globally has been pretty big headwind. You can see fixed income up 2.9%. This is represented by the Bloomberg Barclays Aggregate Index. Over the last year, it was the best performing public markets broad asset class, up 8.7% over the full year, June to June. And you can see long gov credit there. So long government and credit securities were up 18.9%. So bested basically everything but gold on this page, at least. And at the bottom, you can see some of the alternatives highlighted there. And over the year, you can see gold up 27.4%. So within your commodity portfolio, gold probably did well. Precious metals, gold and silver were up. But if you look at the Bloomberg Commodity Index just right above it, it was down 17.4%. So a lot of commodities were down as, of course, industrial demand and manufacturing slowed so dramatically in the beginning of this year. So let's turn to page 5, please. I like this chart because it shows the severity in the dramatic recovery of the S&P 500 compared to two previous significant crises, the tech bubble in the blue line, the great financial crisis in the green line. And what you're looking at here is market peak to trough from sort of day one, and when did it, how low did things go and when did we recover? So if you look at the gold, literally V, that was the COVID-19 crisis, and that was the trough. The peak was February 20th to the current. Of course, the trough was in March. But you can see how quickly we went through what is considered a bear market, which is down 20%. It didn't take very long, and it only took 23 days to get down to negative 33%. So it was the fastest bear market in history, 16 trading days. But then you can see how quickly we've recovered. And really, if this is through July 17th, and if we were to continue that line, you would see that is, we've broken through the zero. We are ahead of where we were at the peak in February, at least at one point. I know the market has sold off recently, but in August, I think we broke through the break-even point for this year. But you can see the other two crises took a long time to unfold. You know, we had time to sort of react to it, time to sort of plan for it, time to readjust portfolios. Active managers had a little bit more of an ability to sort of think about it. They couldn't even think about this. 16 days the market fell, and rebalancing in that period of time, it was incredibly difficult because that offer spreads, especially fixed income, were very difficult. It was hard to trade, so a lot of trades were taking place with financial futures. But you could see that this was an extraordinary event. On page 6, the title of the stage is Swift Recovery for Equities. Did investors get ahead of themselves? And I think we saw the investors kind of vote with their feet this week, late last week with the tech sell-off. Is if you look at these metrics, the economics of what's going on, sort of the Main Street part instead of the Wall Street part, you can see oil prices down, consumer confidence down, durable goods orders down. I mean, you get the picture. All of these numbers are down, which would not necessarily support a big rally in the S&P 500. So arguably, we have a long road to get us back in repair on some of these key economic metrics. So I'm going to go ahead and just skip to page 11, and we'll talk a little about the OPERF portfolio. So the fund ended the second quarter, June 30, with $74.1 billion. That represented an increase of $1.4 billion in the second quarter. You could see in the first column kind of how each of the major components of the portfolio did. So the very top row is the total fund. It was at 2.95%, or roughly 3%, for the quarter, and that was lower than the policy benchmark return of 3.8%. And for the fiscal year, you could see you were positive, but a fairly weak positive 52 basis points. And you can see that that was lagged the 2.6% return that we'd expect from your policy benchmark. But not to make the news too negative, if you look at the 10-year number, you can see that the fund is compounded at 8.5%, which is far ahead of your actuarial rate of return, which is currently, I believe, 7.2%. But sort of peeling back the layers of that onion of why the disappointing kind of fiscal year number, and we're going to look at a couple of charts in a few minutes that are going to kind of tease out kind of where this all came from. But you can see that the fixed income did its job, up 7.8%. That was ahead of the custom fixed income benchmark. Where things started to get a little dicier was in public equity. You can see that you were down 1.7 when the benchmark was up 1.2. So that was a significant difference. If you look at real estate, and of course the fiscal year is really not a good measure, but the printed number for real estate for the fiscal year was 4.6. We generally focus on the much longer term for real estate, the opportunity portfolio, alternatives, and private equity. But just trying to understand the fiscal year return, you see real estate lagged its benchmark as well, up 4.6. The opportunity portfolio was essentially flat. Alternatives were down. And if you look at these benchmarks, we're using CPI plus 5 for the opportunity portfolio, CPI plus 4 for alternatives, and you'll see the Russell 3000 plus 300 basis points on a quarter lag for private equity. These are market-based benchmarks, and these are not all market-based portfolios, especially private equity and real estate. So you can see that private equity outperformed its benchmark, if you will, lagged, but you can see that it was the full one-year return was only about a little over 1%, and a negative return from alternatives, which Ben just spent a lot of time talking about in the opportunity portfolio. So let's go to the public equity portfolio on page 12, which is next, and talk a little bit about those headwinds. So if you look at the total public equity portfolios, this includes all the public equity, including international. You see it was up 18.3%, so that's a good return, but it lagged the index by a little. And then you can see for the fiscal year it was actually negative relative to the ACWI IMI, which is the benchmark for the total public equity portfolio. So some of the sources of the lag, especially for the fiscal year, were in the market-oriented portfolio section, and that had to do with two portfolios in that part of the U.S. equity portfolio broadly that had value orientations, the DFA portfolio and the OST risk premium portfolio, which also has a value bias. And value has underperformed dramatically over this period of time. So that was a pretty significant headwind based on the Russell 3000 measurement. And you can see the difference in look at the large cap value index performance. Year over year, it was down 8.8. And you can see that the portfolio lagged, and that had much to do with one manager, AJO, in that portfolio, which is at a value orientation. And then the small cap, again, I feel like a broken record, it's value. So if you look at, I think Ben might have given you the year over year, but I'll give you a little bit of an idea of year to date. And unfortunately, some of this trend of large outperforming small and growth outperforming value hasn't changed much. So year to date, the Russell 3000 growth is up 19 roughly, and the Russell 3000 value is down 12. So that's a spread of 30%. I mean, that is just huge. But if you look at large cap, it's 32%. And if you look at small cap, it's 20%. So growth has been beating value by a wide margin. We did see that quarter to date, so post June 30, we saw small caps start to perform a little better and small cap value start to perform better. So small cap value actually beat the broader Russell 2000 index over that same period. So maybe, you know, a month or two is not a trend, but we do see smaller caps doing better and value-oriented stocks doing a little better. On page 13, we just take a similar look at the non-U.S. equity portfolio. For the quarter, it was up 17.7%, so a strong performance and beating its benchmark up 17%. You can see that the benchmark also outperformed the benchmark for the fiscal year as well. And you can see that this, if you look down, if you let your eye drop down, the only place where we saw some underperformance relative to the benchmark for the fiscal year was international small cap. All the other portfolios really outperformed their benchmarks. And lastly, for the asset class performance on page 14, this is fixed income. The total fixed income portfolio was up 3.9 for the quarter and 7.75 for the year, and that was ahead of the custom benchmark in both cases. And this is, of course, getting ready to change fairly substantially as Jeff now has approval for all the specialty portfolios. This will migrate to the new structure here in the not-too-distant future. So this page will look very different going forward. So on page 15 is where I want to spend – 15 and 16 are two pages I'd like to spend a minute on, because if you remember, if you stopped the clock in March of this year, your rankings were 9th percentile and 8th percentile for the quarter and year respectively. You move us forward one quarter, and you can see what happened with the rankings. They went to 99th percentile in both cases. So we see the ranking really decline, and we're going to spend a minute and talk about that. And it has an impact. That one quarter moved forward also even impacted the 10-year rankings as well. So we talked a little bit about the total fund, and here the difference between the 52 basis points that we showed on the previous page for the total fund is gross of fees. These numbers on this page, excuse me, are gross of fees. So net, you are at 52. So on page 16, I wanted to just explain this a little bit. We've talked about this in the past, and I know John Sherbin had also spoken to the council about this in the past, and why you bounce around so much in the rankings. Sometimes it can occur in a very short period of time, like what we're seeing now from March to June. So let me just acclimate you to this page. So on the top box is the 331 numbers, so the first quarter. And you can see the quarter and the year performance for the fund and its respective rankings in those periods of time, and the 5 and 10 year. So you can see these are really excellent numbers, all top 10th percentile across the board. And then you look at, just move everything forward, add a quarter, drop a quarter, and then you can see what's happened as of June for the quarter, the year, the 5 and 10 years. So because the OPERF portfolio has less public equity than its peers by almost 10%. The universe that we're measuring you against here has 10% more at the median than you do in public equity, and they have less in private equity. So when public equity does really, really well relative to private equity, your rankings are going to drop in this peer universe. It has nothing to do with your actual performance. It's just how do you look relative to your peers. And then, so you can see that in the top chart, that when public equity in the first quarter was down 14.3% and the private equity portfolio was up 16.4%, your rankings were very high because you had less of the thing that did the worst. But fast forward, and that less of the things that did the best is what hurt you in this period ending June. So you had less public equity was the best performing, and private equity was actually negative because it's a one-quarter lag and it started picking up the valuation changes resulting from the first quarter market decline. So I know I went through that relatively quickly, but I just wanted to give you a sense of how volatile that can be. Plus, if you look at the quarter that was rolled off of the 10-year period, the equity index was up 3.1 in the first quarter, and it was up 19.2. That's what you added on. So that would have also hurt the 10-year number. So it just depends, because you're so different from your peer universe, that that U.S. equity performance versus private equity performance in any shorter period of time. It tends to average out, of course, over the long run, but over the short run can dramatically impact the rankings. So let's look at page 17, because this kind of shows you the rolling 10-year returns for the fund. That's the green line, and the little numbers that are above it are the ranking of the portfolio, and each point represents a 10-year period. So we're just rolling everything forward one quarter, okay, and then we 10 years, then roll, then 10. So you can see this goes back to 2000 because the first period is 2010, and so you have to subtract 10 years for that first period. But you can see those numbers are all really outstanding. And they're all in the upper quartile and, in many cases, in the top decile. But you can see over this most recent 10-year period, which we just talked about in the last two pages, that while you're still very strong relative to peers, your ranking took a little bit of a dip from where it was on the first quarter when you were roughly at fifth percentile. I'm going to just stop there and see if you have any questions.
This is Monica. I had a question. I know this is possibly, you know, not possible, but, like, is there any thought to, if you took the top five tech companies out of the public equity returns over the last quarter and comparing to, like, that, do you know what I'm saying, I guess?
I do. In fact, that's a really good point. If you took the five, like, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Google. If you took those five out, Facebook, thank you. I knew I was missing one of the letters in FANG. Is that the index is pretty flat. The Russell, if you take the S&P 500 and take those out, the 495 remaining stocks were relatively flat. So we had a very narrow market, which also doesn't play well to your hand when you have all your portfolios are all cap in orientation. And the S&P 500 is so concentrated in these five sort of growth stocks, although some of them are not technically in the growth in the tech sector, but they are growth-oriented stocks. Yes, that has been a big impact, a very narrow market in this rally, right, the post-COVID.
Out of curiosity for nothing else. I mean, I know that it doesn't matter and you can't do that, but I'd be curious, like, how we would look relative to, you know, in terms of rankings, if those things weren't neutralized, if those, you know, if you didn't count those five. But it's more of a thought.
Your smaller capitalization bias does hurt you a little bit, and the international. So if you just looked at your public equity portfolio, measuring that against the S&P 500 wouldn't be fair. But if we took your U.S. equity portfolio, which has a very all-cap but a little smaller capitalization but a value tilt, you look very different from the S&P 500, but not as far away from the Russell 3. So benchmarking here is really important when you look at relative performance. But it you do have some style tilts within your U.S. equity portfolio, as most large investors do. Many of our clients have value biases and have smaller capitalization biases for very good reasons. It's just been very difficult in this environment, really, and it's not just this period of time. This is going back quite a ways now. I mean, I think you go back 5 or 6, 7, 8 years, and you can see that growth has outperformed value and large has outperformed small. And so we are at levels of dispersion on those two metrics that are pretty extreme. So the hard part and the part that everybody that we have to think about, that the council has to think about, is these are intentional. There were reasons why these particular biases were put in the portfolio, and you maintain conviction in them, and because the tendency is to always move at the wrong time. When the pain is the worst is when people tend to capitulate and take those biases off, and lo and behold, the next 5 years is you just undid what you just locked in the losses, if you will. So to maintain your discipline here is important. But we're happy to try to get that data and just look at, you know, some people have asked us to include equal-weighted S&P 500 because that's another way of addressing that lack of breadth. But the Russell 3000 is the index we use to measure the U.S. equity portfolio for the council.
Other questions of Jenna?
This is member samples. This is more a comment than a question, but I would just say that anytime you make large bets, whether those bets be relative to a benchmark or a peer group or a consensus, by definition, your performance will vary relative to whatever that measurement is. That's sort of the definition or the purpose of making large bets. So we, just in response to your comments, I think we understand where we are. And I think that this is the reason why most people don't make large bets, because generally it's seen as better to fail with a crowd than succeed on your own. Truly, it's more acceptable to fail with a crowd than succeed on your own. But, you know, like you said, if we have a sense of history, we can understand why the decisions were made and hopefully continue to make good decisions.
Indeed.
Further questions?
And the
hearing none. Janet, that's your report?
That is my report. Chair Russell, thank you.
Thank you. Rex, then you're on the agenda.
All righty. Let me skip to the appropriate pages just to sort of wrap up this meeting. I won't touch on the OPRF asset allocation. We just sort of went through a review of that. But I did want to very quickly note for SAFE and Common School Fund. For SAFE, you'll see that the asset allocation is in line with targets. For the Common School Fund, we are still in the process of building out the exposures for real estate and alternatives, and so you'll see the actual being a little bit underweight with that money being held in fixed income. But Mike Viteri and his team will continue to build out that portfolio over time. And then in terms of SAFE, excited to note that we have hit a new high watermark. And then for Common School Fund, which is similarly built to OPERF, we are still in the midst of recouping some of the losses from COVID-19. And then just moving on from there, in terms of the future calendar, as I noted earlier, over the last couple meetings, we've had a very, very jam-packed calendar, and that was owing to the fact that we wanted to be cautious and conservative as we moved into this virtual environment. And so I think at this point we are pretty well caught up with some of the agenda items that we had pushed back a little bit. And so hopefully the forward calendar will be a little less jam-packed, nonetheless as important as prior meetings as well. The other thing I wanted to note is that if you'll note for December, January, and March, you'll see a slight difference from prior calendars in that what we have decided to do is to group some of the annual reviews for the various asset classes a little bit closer together in preparation for the April asset allocation meeting, which is one of the more important meetings for the system. And then, of course, in June of next year, we have the OIC and PERS joint session. And so with that, Chair Russell, I'll turn it back to you, and I also want to note that we do have one public comment as well. So.
Yes, yeah, we do. But this is the time in the agenda where we welcome
open discussion by council members of issues that we should be concerned about. So, fellow council members, please. Hearing none, I have several that these are issues that I think are worthy of discussion. These comments are not meant to be anything else other than just stirring the pot for discussion. One of those is venture capital, to the extent we can and should invest in that and how. Another is the committee structure. I think I detect a wish to have those committees structure more on expertise. That's the treasurer's responsibility. And lastly, and I say this with a lot of trepidation, investing in currencies is something that is common, I think, in other portfolios, and it's perceived as being risky. I'm sure it is, but anyway, I'd hope that we would take a look at that. Any further discussion by council members?
Mr. Chair, at the risk of repeating myself, I thank the staff and our consultants on the development of our ESG statement. I'd extend that thanks to the council for taking that seriously. I think it was in this context that I raised that several meetings ago, so I'm really pleased that we're taking that on as a council, and I thank you and other members as well.
Yes, and I agree, Treasurer Reid. And I hope there's not the impression by the fact that we just ratified that this is a new phenomenon to us, because as we all know, this has been an issue for us for a long time.
Nor that we're done with it. Both of those are true.
Right. Thank Good. You. Any other discussion? If not, there is a public comment, and it's brief enough that I think I can just read it. It's from Bill Parrish of Parrish and Company, and it is on June 15th, 2020, two U.S. Senators, Kevin Craver and Martha McSally, wrote a letter to BlackRock CEO Larry Fink regarding a perceived double standard in the way BlackRock treats investment in Chinese companies versus American. This letter applies to numerous OIC-based investments, including those by TPG and KKR. They note investments based upon MSCI Emerging Markets Index at BlackRock are now more than 40% represented by Chinese-domiciled companies who, quote, flaunt U.S. financial regulations, unquote. And then, quote, it is in the public interest to investigate why BlackRock is not fulfilling its fiduciary responsibility regarding disclosure with these poorly governed, secretive Chinese companies, unquote, they add. I would also question what is emerging about a fund whose top two holdings with a combined market cap of $1.4 trillion are Alibaba and Tencent, both of whom withhold more than 35% of shares outstanding from the public, thereby artificially inflating their stock price by constricting supply and grabbing a larger share of indexes that are now driving capital allocation. So that is in the record, and I thank Mr. Parrish for his interest in our deliberations. I think that's it for public comment, and I think at this point the meeting is adjourned.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.